Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
Can you find a way to make a change? And for sure, a lot of people in college think that what they'll do is, as an individual, they're going to go into a particular career. But I think that what we saw then, and I also see now, is that these young women were facing some real difficulties, even sexual violence, perhaps, and that certainly is a trigger for depression and anxiety. But when they came together as a group and weren't dealing with something alone, and informing organizations actually did make a difference. There's a lot that really did change in the 1960s.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we're delighted to bring you episode 130, Women's Liberation and Well-Being. The month of March is Women's History Month. So for this milestone, 130th episode of our podcast, we thought that it would be fitting to put the spotlight on a remarkable woman who we recently lost. Sarah Weddington, who made an enormous contribution to history as a successful litigator in the landmark Roe v. Wade case, and who passed away last December. For most people, that would be a pinnacle, but for Weddington, it was just a springboard. She would go on to serve as an assistant on women's issues to President Jimmy Carter, and it was during this time that she was also instrumental in the Senate's approval of extending the deadline for states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. The ERA, as many of you might know, remains unratified to this day. After Carter lost the 1980 election, Weddington went on to serve as the first woman director of the Texas Office of State-Federal Relations. When she came back to Texas in 1985, she became a motivational speaker, addressing audiences across the country, lectured at Texas Woman's University, where she became an adjunct professor in the Department of History and Government, teaching classes in gender discrimination and leadership, ultimately, at the University of Texas at Austin. But why would Weddington be on the Hogg Foundation's radar? Well, it so happens that she managed to get our attention while she was still with the Carter administration, which resulted in her appearing on a 1970s episode of The Human Condition, the radio series that, yes, the Hogg Foundation produced from 1971 to 1983, hosted by our own trailblazing woman, Burt Kruger Smith. Roe v. Wade is one of the most consequential decisions in American history. It held that a Texas state law banning abortions, except to save the life of the mother, was unconstitutional. Americans may be more familiar with Roe than with any other Supreme Court decision. It's been at the center of political debate for decades, and now faces perhaps its most serious challenge, with the Supreme Court seemingly poised to uphold a Mississippi law that could, many fear, essentially end Roe. Abortion, per se, is not a focus of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and we understand that there are passionate views on all sides of the issue. But this being Women's History Month, we have made an exception for this one woman whose work did, after all, have ramifications for the mental health and well-being of women in Texas and beyond. But this is about more than one woman. In this episode, we're also trying to give you a sense of the history of women's activism in our state, and to ground this one unique offering from our archive in that history. To help us do this, we are very lucky to have with us Dr. Lori Green, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Her work focuses on social justice movements in the mid-20th century, particularly those involving poor and working-class women, Blacks and Latinos. Her first book, published in 2007, was Battling the Plantation Mentality, Memphis and the Black Freedom Struggle. Her current project is The Discovery of Hunger in America, a site of public crisis of race, health, and American democracy. And finally, she appeared in the documentary Fight Like a Girl, How Women's Activism Shapes History, and based on the Austin Women Activists Oral History Project, founded by Green in 2017. So without further ado, Lori, hi. We are so glad that you could join us today. How are you?
I'm good. And I'm so pleased that you invited me to do this. There's so much to talk about.
Okay. So for our listeners, I've already gone over this with Lori, but we're going to try something a little bit different for this podcast. Lori and I will be live listening to the Human Condition episode with Sarah Weddington. And I'll be pausing the audio at different points so that Lori and I can have our discussion about the issues that it raises. Sound like fun? Lori, I am ready when you are.
I'm good. Let's go.
From Communications Center, the University of Texas at Austin, this is another program in the series, The Human Condition.
We are trying to work for a day when men and women, together in partnership, can each contribute their best talents so that the world is a better place for all of us.
Produced in association with the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health at UT Austin, these programs are about people and mental health as a part of every human experience. Here is your producer and host, Bert Krueger Smith.
Guest this week on The Human Condition is Sarah Weddington, Special Assistant to the President. Ms. Weddington, I had started to say that you were the president's special assistant for women and minorities, and you corrected me. Why are you just special assistant to the president?
Well, first, when the president and I talked about the job, it's my strong feeling that everyone in the White House has some responsibility for women's issues. And to have one person designated as the special assistant for women's issues somehow tends to indicate otherwise to me. The second part of it, frankly, was that I have been involved in a number of issues other than women's issues, and I wanted the flexibility in my job and my work to work on women's issues, but other issues as well, like the Department of Education, the SALT Treaty, and many others that are current topics.
Well, what are your responsibilities, broadly speaking? And I know you can't delineate them all, but at the White House.
In part, I am a member of the senior White House staff. In that capacity, I attend the cabinet meetings, which are held about every 2 weeks, the senior White House staff meetings. I also try to have a special responsibility for seeing that women's interests and that women are included in all of the events of the White House and as much as possible in government, so that I meet regularly with Stu Eisenstadt and sit in on his staff meetings, so that as domestic policy is made, we can ask the question, how does this impact on women? Or when Ann Wexler helps to plan programs and briefing sessions on various topics.
She was still so young.
I help look to see that women and interested women's organizations are included. Or when we plan a White House conference on small business, to look to be sure that of those who are planning the conference, a proportion are women, that they're included as speakers, as attendees. So it is, by and large, to help carry out the president's commitment on women's issues. And that is, by and large, seeing that they are included in the activities of the White House.
What do you consider, Ms. Weddington, as the predominant issues that impact on women in our society?
Well, there are a number. I think I would summarize them by saying that what we are seeing more than anything today are the variety of women and their lives. and trying to realize that we have to address a variety of those concerns. For younger women, it may be education. For women coming out of schools, it's advancement in professions. It's looking at income levels. I think the economic issues are crucial. For older women, it may be Social Security and pension and retirement interests. But I'd say overall the interest is to allow the woman a freedom of choosing roles and of economics.
Do the minority issues have a large part in the overall dilemmas, or I won't say problems, but the overall dilemmas and concerns about women?
Yes, and I've tried to be particularly conscious about reaching out to minority women, both in the informal way of having various groups for breakfast at the White House, by participating in programs, for example, the LULAC 50th anniversary event in Texas, by trying to look at the issues. Minority issues are a combination of poverty and middle class issues. Poverty in the sense of welfare, education, economic issues.
Okay, so let's just jump in right there. This interview took place during the Carter administration, Lori. Can you give us, you know, kind of your historian's sense of what was going on with women's rights in the country at that time? That would set the stakes for Weddington's work.
Sure, and I'd like to place her first. I was just struck by some of what she says in her opening, in her interview, and I want to mark that she's still in her 20s, and you can hear the idealism that she has as a young woman. She's several years out of law school, has wound up first in the Texas legislature and then in the Carter administration, and has really, she's coming from Austin, Texas. She's really been listening, part of things there, even before she was involved with Roe v. Wade, which is what she's most famous for. And I wanted to note where this whole segment begins with this quote.
Yeah.
From Eleanor Roosevelt, and I actually wrote it down. I was so impressed with this. Eleanor Roosevelt had died about 15 years earlier, so in the early 1960s. Eleanor Roosevelt, at the time, was involved with President Kennedy's Commission on the Status of Women and was involved with so much of what Sarah Weddington talks about in this issue, in this interview. So Roosevelt said, "We are trying to work for a day when men and women, together in partnership, can each contribute their unique talents so the world is a better place for all of us." It astounded me. It's not what I expected. I thought that she would be specifically talking about women. And there's this vision for a better future.
Yeah.
So it's not just the immediate, but where we can go. And I think it's the basis for the idea of choice. So Roe v. Wade was about a woman's choice and the idea that women could develop as they wished in their unique, diverse ways without having barriers, legal barriers in front of them. So it relates a lot, this idealism about choice, and she mentions freedom with this quote from Eleanor Roosevelt. So I was really impressed by that. As far as the question about what she's most concerned with during the Carter administration,
mm-hmm.
Let me just place this as well in a couple ways historically. So Roe v. Wade, which she took to the Supreme Court, had happened in 1973. She was already at the same time in the Texas legislature. And so this is now, you know, roughly half a decade after that. And one of the things that she is really involved with, and she talks about in her autobiography, is the stage of her life that she says there's a stage of her life that's about getting Roe v. Wade, and then there's the stage of her life after that, trying to keep it intact. So one of the things that happens just as Carter is about to take office is the passage in Congress of the Hyde Amendment. What the Hyde Amendment did was it narrowed Roe v. Wade by having the federal government not allow Medicaid funds, so federal funds, to be used by poor women for abortions. Whatever one thinks about that, in terms of the history of Roe v. Wade, it means that there was a compromise and it singled out women in poverty who now were kept out of the group that had the freedom to have an abortion for whatever reason. And there are various reasons that she believed women wanted to have an abortion. So she's very much involved from 1973 on in trying to protect Roe v. Wade. And that would continue on throughout the rest of her life. And she just passed away at the end of 2021. And then there are other big issues for her, like the failure to have passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. So the Equal Rights Amendment had first been proposed in the 1920s, directly after the 19th Amendment with women's suffrage. And then it was reintroduced several decades later, and they didn't have quite enough states that would ratify this amendment, which simply said that, simply talked about equal rights for men and women. And Sarah Weddington talks about getting an extra year, so extending the number of years so that we could just get that one more state to ratify, and it didn't happen. So that would have been probably for Sarah Weddington, not a moment of depression, but probably a moment of, you know, putting her nose to the grindstone and working even harder and outreaching to other women even more. We still do not have it today, which is something my students are always asking, you know, why don't we have this? Yeah. And then she mentions a lot of other issues like economic issues, et cetera.
Okay, thank you for that. Let us get back to the human condition conversation.
Social Security in general has been a concern. HEW has released a report that outlines a number of problems in the Social Security area. First, when I was practicing family law in Texas a few years ago, it was the law that if a woman had been working inside the home and was divorced before being married 20 years, she could not get any benefit from her husband's Social Security. Now that's been changed so that after 10 years of marriage, a wife can claim against her husband's benefits. There is another problem in that women who work often find they can get greater Social Security by claiming under their husband's, since he will often have had a larger salary, and so their own contributions are really not included at all. Or for those women who are divorced and are eligible, they still cannot claim benefits until their husband actually retires, and some choose to work much longer and do not claim it themselves, and their ex-wives are not eligible. Or even that a wife who is eligible while her husband is living only draws half of what he would. So there are many problems within the Social Security system. One of the recommendations we are looking at that HEW has made is the possibility of taking the total contributions by both husband and wife, or by family members who are married, and halving them so that each party to the marriage gets half the benefit of the contributions made during the marriage. I don't anticipate legislation during the current session of Congress, but I think in a year or two there well may be legislation in that area.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the working women. I'd like to ask you two parts to this question. One is about the traditional jobs that women hold, and maybe the other side of that is the non-traditional jobs. The other is that with 54%, I believe it is, of married women who are working, what are the special needs that we need to consider on behalf of children in such families?
First, in terms of traditional, We do find that now over 50% of all adult women are in the workforce, and by 1990, it is estimated that the figure will be 67%. It's also a figure not quite that high, but generally much higher for women even who have minor children. Of those women who work, 80% are in jobs that are non-managerial, non-professional, non-technically skilled. And as women have gone into the workforce in increasing number, the percentage of women in the traditional service areas has increased. One concept that is now being examined is a concept not simply of equal pay for equal work, but a concept of equal pay for work of equal value. Beginning to look at the contribution that women have traditionally made as secretaries, teachers, nurses, and in many other professions that traditionally are not as well paid as others, and trying to determine how you can establish a value for work.
Okay, so she threw a lot at us during that segment.
Indeed.
Talking about Social Security, equal pay for equal work, or as she put it, equal pay for equal value. And so, my next question, Lori, is, how does the things that she's talking about map onto present day concerns about equity for women?
Well, let me start with where she ended on the question of the meaning of equal pay. We just last week had an equal pay day around the country, equal pay day. And one of the issues that comes up year after year, going the references to the Equal Pay Act of 1963 during the Kennedy administration, is this exact issue that we achieved back in 1963, equal pay for men and women in the exact same jobs. So before there had been discrimination against women, those issues were taken up by the EEOC, for instance. So those were fairly straightforward to litigate, and I'm guessing that she might have been involved with such cases. But going back to the early 1960s and then on to right now, and this could be, this interview was in the late 1970s, but we could actually talk about this today. Usually we use the term comparable worth. So that means that men and women are in different jobs, and the women are making less because those jobs are devalued. And often women are actually hired into certain kinds of jobs, say in manufacturing, not just as secretaries, with the idea that women can be paid less, right? So since the early 1960s, again with the President's Commission on the Status of Women under the Kennedy administration, this issue came up powerfully that women doing jobs that were equally as valuable to society, that involved the same level of skill and work, that there should be a way of determining that those should have equal pay as well. Unfortunately, that did not make it into the Equal Pay Act of 1963, and it's come up time and again. So it's so interesting hearing that it's one of her main issues in, this may have been around 1978, and it's one of her main issues. And again, it's still really important issue.
So here at the Hogg Foundation, we're fond of making the distinction between equity and equality. So equity, and we're not the first to frame it this way. Equity, as we define it, and as we've been trying to put it into practice, involves more than just treating people the same, because that's kind of. What we see as the limitations of equality, that it doesn't sufficiently take into account, how resources and opportunities are actually distributed in society, and it doesn't take into account the different starting points you know, that people have in the race that they're running. And so so what you just said kind of, I think, you know, it rings a bell and resonates with, you know, with what we've been saying quite frequently over the last few years. So I did appreciate that.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Did you want me to talk a little bit about the Social Security issue as well?
Sure. Yeah, go. You can go ahead.
Okay.
I'd love to hear what you have to.
Well, the Social Security issue came up in the 1970s, and I love that she was taking this on. The original Social Security Act during the New Deal, which was ushered in by another great woman, Frances Perkins, who was the Secretary of Labor, which is so important under Roosevelt. She got that through, the Social Security Act, but which was partly old age money. But there were flaws in it. And I actually wanted to mention a few of the flaws, but one of the flaws is this assumed dependency of a woman on her husband, so that he's the one who's the earner. He has a Social Security number, and she's the housewife. And certainly there's this expectation of women being housewives, at least in certain stratas of society. And so they're not getting anything going into Social Security. So it's unpaid housework, right? And this comes up as a big issue. So for married women, just how she discusses it, that for married women, they need to, they're dependent on their husband's Social Security. They need to wait for that, regardless of their age and when he stops working. If they are divorced, they don't have access. So there were a lot of problems, and they came up with the women's movement in the 1970s. And so it's great to sort of capture her working on that during the Carter administration. And it wouldn't have been something that she just thought of, you know, from her own head, but something that had come out of the movement. And I just want to say, too, it's wonderful that she talks about the variety of different women that she says she's become so conscious of in her job. And so a couple issues back to Social Security about that is that the Social Security Act originally it literally excluded agricultural workers. So not just people working in the fields, but anyone in the agricultural industry, say in a canning factory, whatever, and also domestic workers. So those were two big areas where women were working and did not have Social Security cards, had really difficult labor, and were earning nothing from the government. So when those women reached their 60s, 70s, they had nothing to fall back on. And it was very difficult for those people in their years as seniors.
Okay. Returning to Sarah and Bert Cougar Smith for more of their conversation.
We also are aware that of those women who do work, 2/3 of them work because they are the sole support of themselves and their families, or because their husbands make less than $10,000. So economic necessity is the primary reason women work. We are trying to open up some of the non-traditional areas because they are often the higher paying ones, but we are also trying to re-examine the traditional occupations, recognizing that perhaps they should be paid more. As women do work, there obviously is a concern for their children. Many people who have minor children have indicated that they prefer children to be cared for with relatives or with family and neighbors, if that is possible. We are looking more and more at the need for daycare, however, and there are many children who do not have people or facilities to look after them following schools. There are a variety of programs that are being examined, some by schools opening their facilities to stay later until women might finish their work. Others are involving fathers more in care of children. Others are of providing child care, particularly for those in the lower income brackets, and of the ability to deduct child care expenses for those who are working. We don't have the answer yet, but I think it is critical, and I think child care is one of the primary issues of concern for women, that we continue to look for better solutions on behalf of our children.
One of the aspects that we have not discussed is the possibility of working flexible schedules. Of course, we do see now that there are some families where one member works a night shift and one a day shift in order to look after children. But I'm wondering, Ms. Weddington, should business and industry accommodate the needs of parents of minor children? How can they and should they be responsible for so doing?
We are first looking to the federal government. Congress last session passed, and the president has signed, bills asking federal agencies to have more jobs available on a flexi time or a compressed time or a part-time basis. That obviously would be helpful to people who want to phase into retirement, to students, and also to parents with minor children. There are five federal agencies now who are beginning an experimental program. We are hoping that it will be very effective, and we hope that if the federal government can set that kind of example, that private industry will begin to offer more positions on that kind of basis. There are some problems right now, for example, in a flexible job system of figuring benefits, and some of those things we have to work out. But I think it is an area that we definitely should explore, both in terms of professional and non-professional positions.
Do women's issues really differ from other issues? And if so, how do they?
Women's issues, I think, do not differ in the sense that in some aspects every issue is a woman's issue because they do affect women as part of the general population. I do think there are some issues that are of special significance to women, such as child care, that while men certainly should be interested, it is women who've traditionally provided care for the children, and they're the ones who tend to be primarily interested. There also are some specific women's issues, for example, housing. HUD is now doing a major study on the mortgage credit needs of women. We are looking at particularly making business opportunities available to women because at this time only 4% of the businesses in the nation are owned by women. We are looking at encouraging women in appointments and in judicial appointments in particular. So there are both those issues that affect women generally. There are those general issues in which women have a special interest, and there are some issues that impact women specifically. In all of that, I am so conscious that as the role of women change, so do those of men. And one of my favorite sayings is one by Eleanor Roosevelt, which hangs in my White House office, that says that we are trying to work for a day when men and women, together in partnership, can each contribute their best talents so that the world is a better place for all of us.
Okay, so there's that quote again. Nice. So I really want to broaden our lens a bit here. So we deliberately chose to feature Sarah Weddington just because we happen to have this, you know, this old radio episode about her. But she was just one person, and so more in keeping with the values of the current day Hogg Foundation, you know, I really would like to say some things about all the lesser known contributors to the historical moment that she's talking from, and maybe even a little bit about the, you know, kind of the hidden histories that, you know, that you as a historian kind of make your stock in trade. So whatever you can give to our listeners.
I love your phrase about the hidden histories that would make my stock in trade.
Yeah.
I was just talking to my students yesterday about how it's the surprises, it's the what you didn't expect from what you know about history that you go digging into, and that's where books come from. So I talk about that all the time. And I think it's apropos to comment on the most important hidden history that I found out about since both even moving to Texas and the roots of Roe v. Wade that I think most people don't know and would probably like to know because it's kind of inspiring. So as a women's historian, in my training, I read what there was to read on the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s, and that, of course, includes the achievement of Roe v. Wade in 1973, and it includes some of the activism in the Midwest, in the North, in quite liberal states, where states decided to liberalize laws around birth control and abortion. And then those books jump forward and they talk about the ramifications, what comes after Roe v. Wade. So there's a story missing. And even the story of Sarah Weddington is not well known outside of Texas. When I began the project that was mentioned at the beginning, the Austin Women Activists Oral History Project, that now includes 41 interviews, mostly of women who were activists at UT and in Austin in the 1960s and 70s. These interviews were conducted by students who were certainly as wowed as I was in what they found. What I learned was that Roe v. Wade didn't just come out of the head of Sarah Weddington or any other attorney, but that it came out of student activism here literally at the University of Texas. What happened was that women who were active in all kinds of issues began to come together as part of what we call the women's liberation movement. They started having small group meetings that were called consciousness-raising groups, and they began to talk about personal issues that they faced together. So they may have felt very alone in what they were experiencing, and now they were able to talk about it. One of these issues was they couldn't get birth control on campus. So the Student Health Center would not dispense birth control. The sexual revolution had, you know, already happened. They are past the beginning of it. And they were having a hard time. People were coming to them a lot and asking, where can we get that? So a couple of women who were in the sciences or whatnot did research on different forms of birth control and on where you could actually get it. And in 1969, these women founded the Birth Control Information Center. And what happens next is that women begin to come to them to ask about where they could get an abortion, because which was illegal. It was not illegal for women to use birth control, but it was illegal to have an abortion in the state of Texas. So this is in, say, late 1969. And at that point, a couple of women go to Mexico, just over the border, and they look for someone or someones who run clinics that are reliable, where they can trust that they will have a safe abortion. It was not uncommon for women, as we know, to give themselves abortions and have botched abortions, wind up very, very sick from septic abortions and even die. And different clinics had different reputations in Mexico, where it was also illegal, but people were practicing it anyway. So they identify a clinic, they set prices, and then they begin to refer women, high school students, college students, and others to this clinic in Mexico. I don't know whether they helped them get there or not, but they certainly told them where to go to have a safe abortion. And this is something that was near and dear to Sarah Weddington's heart. She had, as an undergraduate, she had actually had an abortion. based on her relationship with the man who became her husband was not yet. She managed to have a safe abortion, but it was an issue that was, again, near and dear to her heart. And she knew these women. She was only out of law school for a couple years, and she was familiar with women who had either were in law school or had partners in law school. So they all connect, and they actually connect. It's such a great story. A couple of these young women start talking to Sarah Weddington at a garage sale to raise money for the for this information center. And they start talking about what the ramifications would be if they were found out. And it's from that conversation that they urge Sarah Weddington to file a federal suit, that this would it couldn't be resolved in Texas. It would need to be resolved at the federal level. And so we had students interviewing these women, and I was blown away. I had no idea. And it just reaffirmed my view that so much happens among young women, even high school and college women, that don't have the fear to take things on, are so idealistic. Sarah Weddington herself was in her 20s. All of the people who were involved with the case were all in their 20s. So I think this is a hidden history that is inspiring, and I think it speaks to today, when there's so much inquiring among young women about what can we do, how can we make a difference.
So we're talking about activism now, and activism is not therapy. Some might argue that point, but I mean, surely it can have its therapeutic and restorative aspects. So what can the mental health field or just, you know, the world encompassing all of those who care about mental health, like the Hogg Foundation, learn from the risks that, you know, that these young women took? And what do you see among today's students that's either similar or different?
I guess I think that the similarities, that there are similarities, even though I also believe that what people are facing today is, in a sense, more difficult because there's been a lot of rollback of some of what was won. But, you know, there's two ways to think about women and their resilience and their perhaps desire to make a change in society for their life's work. And usually we think about that in terms of individual therapy. So people getting individual counseling to face, say, depression. And when I personally think about depression, I think about feeling stuck, feeling like you have no power to do anything to change your life or what you're seeing in society. Right now, there's a lot of depression related to that came out of, now we're 2 years into the COVID pandemic, and a lot of people have been experiencing pretty serious mental health issues of anxiety and depression. I see that with my students. So what the other way is, can you find a way to make a change? And for sure, a lot of people in college think that what they'll do is, as an individual, they're going to go into a particular career. But I think that what we saw then, and I also see now, is that these young women were facing some real difficulties, even sexual violence, perhaps, and that certainly is a trigger for depression and anxiety. But when they came together as a group and weren't dealing with something alone, and informing organizations, actually did make a difference. There's a lot that really did change in the 1960s. I would say that that's very relevant to the mental health field. And I see it today as well. it was certainly not easy with the pandemic to join up with other people. But over the last several years with the current climate, I've found in talking to students that a lot of students really are getting involved with other women or with women and men to deal with important issues.
Returning now to the human condition.
What about international women's issues? Are they similar to or different from those of any particular country?
In some ways, they are different. We are looking at a number of things that I'm working on in the international field. For example, 1975 to 1985 has been declared the UN Decade for Women. The first conference was held in 1975 in Mexico City, and the mid-decade conference will be the summer of 1980 in Copenhagen. The three themes are employment, education, and health, and we are helping to start examining those issues in our own country, and then we'll be working with all the other countries to look at the progress of women on those issues in those countries. I also have been working with the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, composed of 20 European countries, Japan, and the U.S. And at our suggestion, it now appears quite likely that there will be a major conference of OECD countries in January or February 1980 to examine particularly the issue of women and employment. So we are beginning to get into the international aspects of women's issues, and what we see is that so often in especially developing countries, the women's movement comes from issues of poverty, such as education, health, employment, the real economic issues, and that we should be more understanding of the fact that while they are slightly different in their women's movement, they are addressing the most pressing needs of the women of their countries and should look for ways to be helpful.
And in the underdeveloped countries, as some of the people on this program have said, with taking care of infants, some of the great problems are just a matter of survival and not some of the concerns that we have in terms of education or improvement of certain other kinds of conditions. Yeah. Do minority issues in this country for women parallel in some ways those that we've mentioned in the underdeveloped countries? Do we still have a lot of poverty?
Yes, we do. In fact, I had lunch with a number of Hispanic women recently who were pointing out that in many ways the women's movement within minority cultures tends to parallel that in developing countries because they too tend to have the issues of poverty. There are certainly those women, however, who have been very active in business and professional women's organizations, Mexican-American business and professional women's organizations and others, so that I think there is a need for us to better understand how women in our own cultures and in those of other nations are trying to solve their own problems. And I think we are coming to recognize that the federal government cannot solve all problems, or even government generally, and that more and more it is the individuals who are developing, who are stronger, that will offer solutions for other women and other minorities.
But out of your office, your concerns are very much like a layer cake, I suppose. There are whole groups of women whose needs are basic, and other women who, at the top of the cake perhaps, are concerned with professional development and integration into the society.
That's right, and we tend to keep our eye on all of the layers and to be conscious of them and the need to respond to them. At the same time, I think there is a common thread throughout that whole cake. In that what we are truly trying to do is to do away with stereotypes that limit individuals, whether minority, majority, women, men, or others, in the sense of coming to the point where we as a nation say that individuals should be judged and their opportunity should be there according to their individual merits and accomplishments. And that is more than anything else what we are working toward.
Well, finally, Ms. Weddington, could you give us a minute and a half of guidelines about what are the next steps that each of us may take in our own personal world to help solve some of these women's issues we've been discussing?
I think the first thing is a personal concern, to be informed, to be educated, and to express concern about these issues. Second, I think as we as individuals become stronger in our personal and our professional lives, we have the ability more to contribute to the solution of those and to others. And third, I think is a real feeling of responsibility that those of us who have been fortunate enough, as I think everyone has been, to reach a new level of development and personal satisfaction, have the real responsibility in turn to help pull those behind us up and then to move on and pull them up again.
Thank you very much, Miss Weddington. Special guest this week on the human condition has been Sarah Weddington, who is Special Assistant to the President.
That was Bert Krueger Smith with another conversation about the human condition and mental health as a part of every human experience. This program was produced by KUT-FM and distributed by Communications Center, the University of Texas at Austin, in association with the Hogg Foundation.
All right, so that was the end of the episode, and you know they covered more ground. You know the international situation for women, and some other things. So I was just wondering, you know, with that as the jumping off point, Lori, if you had any final thoughts, reflections, or takeaways for our listeners.
Sure. It must have been exciting for Sarah Weddington to be in the Carter administration at this time of this first decade of international women's, not just year, but decade, and to kind of be at the heart of that. And it strikes me that one thing that happened through these international conferences is that for the first time, you actually have women in the less developed countries who were certainly thinking about these issues of poverty and health and education that she names, and coming from a different place, perhaps, than some of the activists who were professional women here in the United States, that they were there, these women from other countries, but also there were low-income women's organizations, women that were representing organizations like the Mexican-American Women's Organization that she referred to, and even the welfare rights movement that had gotten started in the 1960s and was still going forward. So they were actually able to meet each other quite literally for the first time and find out that they had a lot in common. So they clearly had serious differences. They're living in different contexts. And speaking of hidden from history, I think that there's a way in which the deep poverty of women who really most need that education, support for healthcare, even for food security, for education, the way that could become hidden. And so the fact that Weddington is calling that out, she's talking about the parallels, and she's keeps talking about the diversity of women and what can be done to help women living in poverty. The issue comes up in this conversation about whether poor women, the women who have it the hardest, are too busy surviving to be part of a movement, and yet we so often see historically that it's precisely those people who wind up kind of being at the heart of various movements. So I just have the sense that her experiences in Austin and in Texas, working in a women's movement that was so diverse, and having conversations and understanding, say, from Mexican American women's organizations, that poverty, women's poverty, was so important to who they thought they were, what their goals were, and that they might be different than, say, the most well-heeled women who were looking for equal rights and getting through that glass ceiling. So the fact that Sarah Weddington was and then continued to be in her life so sensitive to that is, I guess, a reason that I'm really proud to be talking about her.
Okay, Laurie Green, I am really glad that I found you on our campus. To someone with so much, rich insight, so nearby. We really do appreciate you taking the time to take part in this conversation. That's a bit of a departure for us. I'm always happy that my friends at the Hogg Foundation indulge my interest in history. This will be, I think, an exciting offering. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. I think it's really important work. And likewise, I am honored to have a connection now to the Hogg Foundation.
At the risk of sounding glib, you can't help but notice that the field of mental health is one where women's leadership and women's labor is ever present. Just in trying to make a difference in mental health, women from all walks of life have effectively made history here in the U.S. and throughout the world. A shining example is our founding matriarch, Miss Ima Hogg, who did as much to advance the cause of mental health as anyone in our state's history. But I'd love to share a more recent example of two women who I have been proud to call my co-workers. Stephanie Bryan and Tammy Hines were hired in 2008 as the Hogg Foundation's first consumer and family liaisons. As program officers, their passion and perspective has been invaluable to making the foundation bolder and more inclusive in its grant-making strategy, among other things. In 2019, to celebrate their then 10 years with the foundation, our 77th episode of Into the Fold explored the consumer movement from the ground up, with Stephanie and Tammy as our guides. Sadly, we lost Stephanie to COVID in February of 2021. Tammy Hines is still very much with us as a program officer and consumer and family liaison, and is integral as ever. Here is some of what they had to say from that episode.
For so long, people like us were stigmatized, and it was seen as only a negative. And therefore, we were consumers of the mental health system, we were survivors of the mental health system, we were patients of a hospital. It's always being of something or some other entity. This allows us to kind of own our own selves again. We get to say, this is our experience, and our experience contributes to the totality of who we are. And part of what creates who I am is my lived experience of mental health, my lived experience of recovery, my lived experience of having mental health issues.
When we talk about the term consumer, Gail Bluebird, I believe, said it best, and she did say that history connects us with our past and with those who have gone before us and those who have earned remembrance. We may not be aware of our rich history, and we belong to that history because it was people before us who started this, and I think it's really important. Many individuals, I think Tammy said earlier, they really don't like the word or the term consumer, but it is part of our history. And it is, as I said earlier, the golden thread that binds us together.
That is from episode 77, Consumer Voice, Its Role in Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Look for it in our catalog or just follow the link in today's show description, wherever you get your podcasts. And that does it for this episode. We are so glad that you could join us. If you have comments or suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Production assistance by Anna Harris, Daryl Wiggins, and Kate Rooney. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or TuneIn, among many others. Thanks for joining us.